I'm very pleased that we have such a remarkable turnout this afternoon for our EPI Awards section. We really pride ourselves on our ability to really showcase and appreciate those among us who have provided great degree of value, innovation, and dedication to this craft that we call epidemiology. Allow me to introduce myself. My name is Oscar Allen. I am the chair of the epidemiology section. I've been very active in the EPI section since a student, and it's with great pleasure and honor that I'm able to serve the EPI section as one of its leaders moving forward. We have in our midst today a mix of not only members of students and also previous leaders of our organization and current leaders of our organization, but we also have very distinguished guests and family and friends as well. So I thank you for being here with us today. We're going to go right into this, aren't we? All right. That's exciting. Where's the Royal Society? I'll ask the representative from the Royal Society to accompany me here.
Hello there.
Hi.
Hi.
I just wanted to make sure you're here with me as we do this. So Duncan represents the Royal Society and the John Snow Society, and it's with our distinct honor and pleasure that we always have this unique collaboration between our societies because, as we love to say, we are the authentic group who has the seal of approval of the John Snow Society. So while there may be other John Snow awards, others exist, but ours is the most authentic. This year, the awardee of our John Snow Award is none other than our own, Captain Polly Marchbanks, Captain Dr. Polly Marchbanks. Polly retired from the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention in June of 2015 after 30 years of distinguished service. She received a BSN and MSN from the University of Texas at Austin and a PhD in epidemiology from the University of Texas School of Public Health in Houston. She joined the CDC and the USPHS Commissioned Corps in 1985 as an EIS officer in the Division of Reproductive Health. She worked in the Division of Injury Epidemiology and Control, where she conducted an analysis on the risk of injury from resistant rape used in the National Crime Survey of the U.S. Bureau of Justice Statistics. This work highlighted the need for a more complete data collection on the temporal sequence of events during a rape incident and led to the redesign of the survey to correct this information. Dr. Marchbanks also worked on the Division of Sexually Transmitted Diseases and HIV Prevention, where she led formulation of national recommendations for chlamydia surveillance and collaborated on national guidelines for prevention and management. Her work contributed to increasing the number of states in which chlamydia was reportable, helping to control this infection through targeted high-risk groups. From 1991 to 1995, she was the first woman and the first non-physician to serve as chief of CDC's EIS program, a two-year program for training and experience in applied epidemiology. In a pioneering effort to facilitate training and evaluation of EIS officers, Polly led development and implementation of an innovative set of learning competencies in the domains of epidemiological process, communication, and professionalism. She contributed to the training of hundreds of EIS officers, and many have taken leadership positions at CDC or other health agencies throughout the U.S. and abroad. With her epidemiologic expertise, teaching skills, and leadership in EIS, she was an inspiring role model for early career professionals. From 1995 until retirement, she served as team leader for the Fertility Epidemiology Studies, FES team, in the Division of Reproductive Health. She served as the principal investigator for the Data Coordinating Center for NICHD, Women's Contraceptive and Reproductive Experiences Study, a multi-center population-based case control study on oral contraceptive use and breast cancer. She first authored a paper on OCs and breast cancer risk in the New England Journal of Medicine that won CDC's Shepherd Science Award for Epidemiology and is in assessment in 2003. In 2012, she first authored a paper on specific OC formulations and breast cancer risks that won the Contraception Outstanding Article of the Year Award. These papers provided reassurance on the safety of OCs as investigators did not find evidence that oral contraceptives increased breast cancer risk. Polly authored over 40 CARE publications. As team leader, she built a team of productive and visionary scientists who conducted research on a variety of women's health topics and developed a robust portfolio of science-to-practice activities on family planning guidance. She oversaw the ongoing identification, appraisal, and synthesis of scientific evidence on which the World Health Organization bases its global family planning guidance, and she oversaw the adaptation of this guidance for the use in the U.S. This was the first evidence-based national family planning guidance in this country. These guidelines have been incorporated as a clinical services strategy in CDC's teen pregnancy winnable battle and are decreasing unintended pregnancy through promoting safe and effective contraceptive use. She serves as an editor of the American Journal of Epidemiology. She's a former president of SCR. She initiated the first epidemiology late-breaker session at SCR's annual meeting and chaired several sessions for several years. She's a member of the Oxford Collaborative Groups on Reproductive Cancer, a member of the Executive Committee and Awards Committee of the APHA EPI section. She served multiple times as a temporary advisor for expert panels at the WHO. She taught epidemiology in Zimbabwe, Romania, Moldova, the Republic of Georgia, China, South Africa, and Ghana. I noticed you didn't say Brooklyn. She authored over 160 scientific publications and is an elected member of the American Epidemiological Society. Polly received the Shepherd Lifetime Scientific Achievement Award, the Watson Medal of Excellence, and the Multiple Commission Corps Award, including the USPHS Distinguished Service Medal. Since her retirement, she's continued her longstanding role as an editor of the American Journal of Epidemiology. She's also serving as an expert in the field of epi and women's health on the advisory panel that is developing the 2016 North American Menopause Society position statement on hormonal therapies after menopause. Finally, she's contributed to collaborate as a guest researcher on multiple projects in CDC's Division of Reproductive Health related to contraceptive safety and breast cancer. Ladies, gentlemen, friends, I present you with our 2016 John Snow Award, Dr. Polly Marchbanks.
I was going to say before I present the awards, but the excitement was killing me. Just to say a few words, and literally just a few words, about the Royal Society for Public Health and the John Snow Society. I'm very honoured to be here. This is my first APHA. The Royal Society for Public Health is the world's longest established public health body. We celebrated our 160th anniversary a couple of weeks ago. We have 6,000 members globally, and we look after the John Snow Society, which is based at the London School of Hygiene and Tropical Medicine. Needless to say, to honour Dr. Marchbank in such a fashion is recognition of the outstanding contribution she has made. So I'd just like to say a big congratulations to you. Thank you very much.
Stay up here, please. And this is where we debut this fantastic, authentic John Snow Award.
Oh, that's lovely. My cup runneth over.
Oh, sorry. I moved quickly.
Harry.
Everyone?
Wonderful. Thank you. Good afternoon. Can you hear me?
Yes.
Great. Well, hello and thank you so much. I am so thrilled and honored to receive this magnificent and absolutely fabulous award. To Oscar and Lori and the awards committee and the entire EPI section of APHA, thank you. And I have loved working with you over the years. I admire and respect your countless contributions to public health and making a difference in the lives of people. And I am deeply grateful that you have been and continue to be an important part of my own personal career journey. To the John Snow Society, thank you so much for the award and for keeping the inspiring legacy of John Snow alive. I have always believed that the work of John Snow is classic, especially the 1854 cholera work, because it epitomizes the concepts of applied epidemiology, not just in one single dimension, but in its descriptive and analytic and consequential aspects. And I can't tell you how many times I have used the work of John Snow as an example when teaching epidemiology and giving epidemiology lectures. So to actually receive the John Snow Award and this fabulous cup, which I just noticed, it looks like I might be a member of the John Snow Society now, which is just... This just means so much to me. It means the world to me. Just getting the award, and I had no idea I would become a member of the John Snow Society. It's just great. And last but not least, I want to share with you that my husband, Harry, and I are repeat devoted patrons of the John Snow Pub in London. We have been big John Snow Pub fans for years. We love the historical ambiance, and of course the pub is located at the site of the historic Broad Street pump, and we especially love browsing through the memory book and reading the entries written by epidemiologists from around the world. And we love composing and adding our own entries, which really makes us feel a part of history. And I am just now thinking that given this very significant and very wonderful award, that Harry and I are going to have to make a visit to that pub again very soon, don't you think? Yes, Harry. I don't think he can say no with all this fabulous John Snow energy in the room. So thank you very, very much for this meaningful award that is so meaningful to me in so many different ways. I will treasure it always, and it is truly a career highlight. So have a great meeting, and all the best to each of you.
And Pauly, I'm member number 1892.
Oh!
I'm so bad, I laminated and I carried in my wallet with me. Next up, I will ask our chair-elect, Dr. Lori Ellum Evans, to present our next awardee.
Good afternoon. Victor Schoenbach is Associate Professor in the Department of Epidemiology at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill at the Galen School of Global Public Health. With the help of co-instructors and over 200 teaching assistants, he has taught introductory epidemiology to some 300 epidemiology majors and 6,000 non-majors since 1980. He has led and co-led observation and intervention studies on smoking cessation, HIV, and other sexually transmitted infections, concurrent sexual partnerships, and other topics. He has also directed the UNC's Minority Health Project and has produced some 20 national webcasts in health equity, and has also worked with the UNC Minority Student Caucus on its annual Minority Health Conference and broadcast. Dr. Schoenbach maintains websites that disseminate his evolving texts, lecture slides, exercises, case studies, and other learning resources, including the most recently, a virtual library for a course on social justice and equality. He co-teaches with Bill Jenkins. He has, in 1983 to 2004, he received an award for leadership and distinguished service from the American College of Epidemiology. He has also received a Teaching Excellence Award from the Hubert H. Humphrey Fellowship Program Class of 2005. And in 2008, he was inducted into the Frank Porter Graham Graduate and Professional Student Honor Society. He received his bachelor's degree in Harvard College at Columbia University. He met his Master of Science in Economics from the London School of Economics, his Master's of Science degree in Public Health, his PhD in Epidemiology, and his postdoctoral degree in Psychosocial Epidemiology, all from the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. Go Tar Heels. Please join me in welcoming to the stand our 2016 Abraham Lilienfeld Teaching Award to Dr. Victor Schoenbach.
Our publicity department asked if they could have a photo, and I guess they will have a photo. So I am profoundly grateful to whoever so graciously proposed me for the Abraham Lilienfeld Award, and to the epidemiology section leadership for selecting me. Thanks also to all of you for coming to share this very special occasion. This award is a signature destination for me on a journey that began at least 44 years ago when I hitched a ride to the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill, and on the strength of having met his sister, asked Tom Randolph if I could camp out on the floor of his freshman dorm room. During the following week, I saw an announcement about a course in human sexuality that Tacky Crist was teaching at the School of Public Health. My visit to that course led ultimately to my enrollment in the Health Education Master's Program, thanks to Lewis Neidorf. My first semester in health education, I took a required introductory epidemiology course, taught by the legendary John Castle. Bert Kaplan, who taught my lab section in that course, and Godfrey Hochbaum, enabled me to enter and succeed in my epidemiology doctoral program, postdoctoral fellowship, and junior faculty years. Bert also gave me the privilege of meeting Abe Lilienfeld in 1984. My first semester in public health brought two other pillars of my career and life success: meeting my wife, Marion, and my brother's recommendation that I learn the practice of transcendental meditation, which enabled me to appreciate her and many other treasures in my life more fully. I have had the great fortune to learn from and even teach with several past Abraham Lilienfeld awardees: David Kleinbaum, Michelle Ibrahim, Sherman James, and Bill Jenkins, and other epidemiology heroes, including Al Tiroler, Barbara Hulka, Carl Shai, Ed Wagner, Gerardo Heiss, David Strogatz, and Charlie Poole, and many others I can't name here. I'm also greatly indebted to our student services managers, including Joyce Allen and Nancy Colvin, co-instructors Michelle Ibrahim, Barbara Hulka, Joellen Schildkraut, and Wayne Rosenman, Guest lecturers including Tim Wilkoski, Carl Shai, David Savitz, Cecil Sheps, David Weber, Celia Hybels, and others, and the five epidemiology chairs who have enabled and facilitated my teaching in the classroom and online during nearly 40 years, providing over 200 teaching assistants who have made it possible to successfully teach 400 epidemiology majors and over 6,000 other students. Among my most exciting research projects was a self-help smoking cessation study in collaboration with the North Carolina Mutual Life Insurance Company and with Dr. Tracy Orleans and Victor Strecker and others. I realized that I was not the right person to be leading a study like that, and that the field desperately needed more researchers from underrepresented groups. That realization led me to work with colleagues on the Minority Affairs Committee of the American College of Epidemiology, Sherman, for example, and Bill Jenkins, and Kamara Jones and others, the UNC Minority Student Caucus, and colleagues on the UNC Minority Health Project to amplify the voices of epidemiologists and other professionals from underrepresented groups. Among my most rewarding accomplishments was recording Bill Jenkins' interview with past Lilienfeld awardee and today's Wade Hampton Frost lecturer, Sherman James, in which Sherman relates the story of his journey to our field. I hope you will listen to the recording of that in YouTube. It is not to be missed. For me, this award is a wonderful recognition of my life's work in teaching introductory epidemiology as a teaching assistant and then faculty member to undergraduates and graduate and professional students, many of whom went on to become, and in some cases were already, faculty, clinicians, and public health professionals. It is their knowledge, support, inspiration, motivation, intelligence, appreciation, and consciousness that I have depended upon. And I had hoped to give some advice to students and young faculty, if there are any here. My one piece of advice is, be nice to your students. They will be your colleagues and your peers. I'm so grateful to you. Thank you very much.
Last but not least is the announcement of the Wade Hampton Frost Lectureship Award. Sherman A. James is a Susan B. King Distinguished Professor Emeritus of Public Policy at Duke University and a Research Professor of Epidemiology and African American Studies at Emory University in Atlanta. Prior to Duke, he taught at the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill, go Tar Heels, okay, and the University of Michigan. At Michigan, he was the John P. Kirsch Collegiate Professor of Public Health, the founding director of the Center for Research on Ethnicity, Culture, and Health, chair of the Department of Health Behavior and Health Education, and a senior research scientist in the Survey Research Center at the Institute for Social Health. I'm tired already. Wow. Dr. James received his AB degree in psychology and philosophy from Talladega College and a PhD degree in psychology from Washington University in St. Louis. Dr. James is the originator of the John Henryism hypothesis, which posits that repetitive, high-effort coping with social and economic adversity is a major contributor to the well-known excess risk for hypertension and other cardiometabolic diseases among poor and working-class African Americans. The John Henryism scale, which is used to test the John Henryism hypothesis, has been translated into 12 languages, among them Spanish, Portuguese, Dutch, Finnish, Korean, Arabic, and Mandarin Chinese. Dr. James was elected to the National Academy of Medicine, which was formerly known as the Institute of Medicine, in 2000. In 2001, Dr. James received the Abraham Lilienfeld Award from the Epidemiology Section of APHA for career excellence in teaching epidemiology. In 2008, he received a five-year Health Policy Investigator Award from the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation. He is a fellow of the American Epidemiology Society, the American College of Epidemiology, the American Heart Association, and the Academy of Behavioral Medicine Research. In 2007 to 2008, he served as the president for the Society for Epidemiologic Research. And in 2008, he was named the Distinguished Alumnus of Washington University in St. Louis. This year, he was elected to the American Academy of Political and Social Science as the Mahatma Gandhi Fellow. Please join me in congratulating the recipient of the Epidemiology Section's 2016 Wade Hampton Frost Lectureship Award, Dr. Sherman A. James.
You're using slides, right?
I have slides, yeah.
Okay, sorry.
You see if there's some outside with the ID people.
Tech.
Yeah, but it said it's already running when we click it. It's already running. Yes, that's why. It says it's already running. That's the problem.
Can you write like enforce credits?
Sorry, Sean. Okay, well, good afternoon, and I want to thank Lori for a really lovely introduction, and I want to thank the Awards Committee for inviting me to give the Wade Hampton Frost Lecture this year, and for the additional pleasure of sharing the awards stage with Vic Schoenbach and Polly Marchbanks, who have just been really wonderful colleagues and contributors to the field of epidemiology over many years, so congratulations to you both. It's really well deserved. Now, despite what some of my increasingly young-looking undergraduate and graduate students think, I did not know Wade Hampton Frost personally. In reading up on him, however, I discovered that he and I have at least two things in common. One, we were both named after Civil War generals. He was named after Wade Hampton, a Confederate Army general, who in the 1870s became governor of South Carolina, my home state. I was named after William Tecumseh Sherman, a Union Army general who wreaked havoc on parts of Georgia and South Carolina in 1864 during his famous, some would say infamous, March to the Sea. I'm awfully glad that my general side won. Two, in a 1976 AJE article, Philip Sartwell, the noted Johns Hopkins epidemiologist, paid a warm tribute to Dr. Frost. He described Frost as a shoe leather epidemiologist, meaning that Frost
personally interviewed and examined individuals who had tuberculosis or one of several other infectious diseases whose descriptive epidemiology he did so much to clarify. I think of myself as a shoe leather epidemiologist as well, in that my own work on the social epidemiology of hypertension in African Americans was grounded at the outset in personal observations of and interviews with individuals diagnosed with the disorder. After Frost's death on May 1, 1938, he was only 58 years of age, an editorial tribute in the Baltimore Sun said this about him, quote, "All who knew him recall at this time the thoughts and the acts that were generous and just, high of mind and mood. He made living a noble venture." End of quote. High praise indeed. Established in 1972, the Frost Lectureship has been awarded to a long list of very distinguished epidemiologists. I would be remiss, however, if I did not mention that the person who introduced me to the field of epidemiology, John Castle, gave the fourth Frost Lecture exactly 40 years ago. Many of us remember his highly cited lecture, "The Contribution of the Social Epidemiology to Host Resistance," to be a classic. In his own tribute to Frost, Castle said this, "Of all the words Frost wrote, the ones that have made the most impression on me have been his often quoted introduction to the reprinting of John Snow's papers. Epidemiology at any given time is something more than the total of its established facts. It includes the orderly arrangement into chains of inference which extend beyond the bounds of observation." This quote continues to resonate with many of us. In the spirit of Frost and Castle, what I shall attempt to do today is to arrange some facts into a chain of inference that goes beyond the bounds of direct observation. In doing so, I hope to give us something to think about, to debate, and ultimately to ponder how to study and understand more deeply using the tools of epidemiology. In varying detail, most of us know that the life expectancy of Black Americans, especially Black Southerners, improved dramatically in the 10 to 15 years immediately following passage of the 1964 Civil Rights Act and related great society legislation, such as the 1965 Voting Rights Act and the Medicare and Medicaid Act, also of 1965. Collectively, this and other legislation outlawed racial discrimination in education, transportation, health care, voting, public accommodations, employment, etc. We should not forget, however, that this expansion of Black freedom and the subsequent reduction, at least through the early 1980s, in Black-white health disparities was an extremely hard-fought achievement, hence the subtitle of my talk, "The Difficult Pathway Toward Racial Health Equity in America." That said, a close examination of empirical studies and relevant theories purporting to explain the rapid health improvements among Black Americans during the late 60s and into the 70s could provide some useful insights into the barriers that must be overcome if additional meaningful progress is to be made in the years ahead. This is a complicated subject with important contributions from a number of disciplines. Because of the usual time constraints, I have had to be selective, but I hope judiciously so, in the material I present. Let's begin literally at the beginning with studies on improved birth outcomes for Blacks between 1965 and 1980. In 2003, two economists, Che and Greenstone, documented a greater reduction in Black than white infant mortality in the U.S. South between 1965 and 1975. The reduction was greatest for Blacks in the rural South, as indicated by the red line. In fact, The reduction in black infant mortality in the rural South was 2.5 times greater than in the country as a whole. The office attributed this to the desegregation of Southern hospitals in 1965, a precondition for any hospital to receive Medicare and Medicaid reimbursement. Pregnant black women in the South, especially the rural South, were likely the greatest beneficiaries of this sudden increased access to professional medical care. The data in this slide are consistent with the medical care explanation. In 1955, fewer than half of black babies in the rural South were born in hospitals, compared to 90% or more for blacks in urban locations and whites in both rural and urban locations. Though hospital births for black infants in the rural South were already trending upward by the mid-1950s, this percentage greatly accelerated after 1965. While these findings certainly suggest a key role for medical care in the post-1965 reduction of black-white disparities in infant mortality, especially in the rural South, increased access to medical care by pregnant black women could not have been the only explanation for their improved birth outcomes. One clue comes from some of my own unpublished data. I compared black-white trends in infant mortality during the 1960s and 70s for North Carolina and for Pitt County, a largely rural, poor county in the eastern part of the state, outlined here in red. In 1960, as now, Pitt County had a substantial poor and working-class black population with high rates of both infant mortality and adult mortality from cardiovascular disease. The high cardiovascular disease mortality was the reason my colleagues and I chose Pitt County back in the late 1980s as the site for our study of the social determinants of hypertension and related cardiometabolic diseases in black Americans. As this slide shows, the decline in black infant mortality during the 1960s and 70s in Pitt County and in North Carolina as a whole is consistent with expectations based on Che and Greenstone's findings. From 1960 to 1970, there was a sharp decline in infant mortality rates for blacks, but little or no change for whites. In the 1970s, large reductions occurred for both races. But whereas Che and Greenstone observed a large gap pre-1965 in the percentage of hospital births for blacks in the rural South compared to whites, this gap was much smaller in Pitt County. As shown on this slide, the percentage of physician-attended births for blacks in Pitt County exceeded 80% by the early 1960s and had approached 90% by 1965. Given that the pre-1965 infant mortality rates for blacks in Pitt County, 50 to 55 deaths per 1,000 white births, were comparable to infant mortality rates elsewhere in the rural South, something other than increased access to medical care post-1965 must be involved. One such factor could have been improved reproductive health of black women as a result of great society investments in protective health and social welfare programs, Medicare, Medicaid, the war on poverty, and in early childhood education and nutrition programs such as Head Start. Pursuing this potential explanation, Allman and Che, in a National Bureau of Economic Research study, found that black women born in the late 1960s were healthier as adults and also had healthier newborns than black women born in the early 1960s. The fact that no similar differences were found for white women suggests that the previously mentioned great society health and social safety net investments fostered not only rapid but also intergenerational health benefits for black females. Thus, based on this research by economists, increased access to medical care by pregnant black women before and during childbirth, plus health protective social policies, may have acted synergistically to improve black birth outcomes between 1965 and 1980. Moving even further upstream in search of explanations, Nancy Krieger and colleagues in a 2013 paper focused on the contribution that the abolition of Jim Crow laws in 1964 and the subsequent fuller participation, fuller political incorporation of blacks into American society may have made to reduce black infant mortality after 1964. Interestingly, they conceptualized race not as a demographic attribute, but as a political relationship between blacks and whites, one perhaps best understood as the power of whites to dominate and exclude blacks from participating as equals in mainstream American institutions. Given that some states not usually thought of as belonging to the South, for example, Kansas and Wyoming, also had Jim Crow laws, the authors contrasted secular trends in black-white infant mortality between Jim Crow polities, that is, states with Jim Crow laws, and non-Jim Crow polities. This slide summarizes one of their major findings. As can be seen, all four groups, regardless of race or Jim Crow polity, experienced decreased infant mortality at least through the mid-1980s, after which rates rose again temporarily for blacks in Jim Crow polities. Consistent with expectations, infant mortality rates declined fastest for blacks in the Jim Crow polities, the top line, during the 1960s. Moreover, as the top two lines indicate, the historic infant mortality disadvantage among blacks in Jim Crow polities compared to blacks in non-Jim Crow polities disappeared altogether around 1970 before reappearing in the late 1980s. Despite these generally favorable trends for all four race polity groups, the 2-to-1 excess black relative to white infant mortality rates persisted throughout the entire 60-plus year period of observation. Numerous studies in recent decades convincingly rule out racial differences in prenatal care as the explanation for this stubborn 2-to-1 ratio. Fully satisfactory explanations of this and other intriguing black health gains from the mid-1960s to the early 1980s remain elusive. However, I think Krieger and colleagues point us in the right direction to achieve new insights by suggesting that we think of race as a political relationship between phenotypically marked groups, each having different and differently valued social identities. As I mentioned earlier, the political relationship between U.S. blacks and whites is probably best understood in terms of the power whites have to restrict the freedom of blacks, or more precisely, their power to dominate and exclude blacks from participating as equals in institutions where resources to protect and enhance life are found. These include, most prominently, our education, economic, healthcare, political, and judicial institutions. Until now, however, research on racial discrimination in health seems to have focused largely on how race-based exclusion from or token inclusion in the aforementioned institutions undermines the well-being of black Americans as a whole. Viewing race as a political relationship between blacks and whites, however, widens our lens to include racial subordination as another potential pathway through which anti-black racism gets under the skin to promote early deterioration of the physical health of African Americans. From what I can tell, the potential health benefits of forced racial subordination is a largely unexplored topic in the public health literature. But before discussing its implications more fully, let me set the stage further with a review of studies on the decline of heart disease and stroke mortality, especially among Southern black women between 1965 and 1980, a decline that closely mirrors that reported for black infant mortality. In 1981, Richard Cooper, a cardiologist, epidemiologist, was the first to document a greater decline in heart disease and stroke mortality for blacks than for whites between 1968 and 1978. The decline was greatest for black women. Cooper and his colleagues suggested that two potential explanations for these results. One, grassroots civil rights activism by blacks in the 1960s that ameliorated psychological stress caused by racist social conditions, and two, advances in hypertension treatment and control in the early 1970s that may have benefited black Americans disproportionately. In 2008, George Kaplan and colleagues asked if this greater reduction in heart disease and stroke mortality for blacks relative to whites was greater in the South than in the non-South. The answer was yes, but only for black women. As shown here, among 35 to 64-year-old women, the black-white coronary heart disease mortality ratio, which prior to 1965 was close to 3.5 in the South, the top line, fell below 3.0 by the late 1960s and to roughly 2.5 by 1975. The mortality ratio also fell in the non-South, the bottom line, but it should be pointed out that not until the early 1970s. The improved black-white CHD mortality ratios pre versus post-1965 was clearly greater in the South. A similar picture, albeit less dramatic, was observed for stroke mortality. Interestingly and importantly, there were no South, non-South differences in mortality trends for cancer pre versus post-1965. In addition, for working-age women in the South, the reduction in the black-white heart disease and stroke mortality ratios pre versus post-1965 resulted in an impressive 60% reduction in the ratio of black-white mortality of all causes. This 60% reduction in the South outpaced all other regions. No similar differences by race and region were observed for working-age men, meaning that the declines in heart disease and stroke mortality for black and white men were similar pre versus post-1965. Summarizing, Kaplan and colleagues speculated that the improved psychosocial and material life conditions for Southern black women post-1964, which took the form of greater access to public sector jobs that were less subservient, more secure, and better paying, gains in social status not enjoyed to the same degree by Southern black men. They believed that this was the most plausible explanation for the improved cardiovascular health of black women post-1965. They also disagreed with Cooper and colleagues that the improved control of hypertension was a major explanation for these differential reductions in cardiovascular disease mortality by race, gender, and region, given that the sharp decline in heart disease mortality among Southern black women began, as I noted earlier, in the late 1960s. This was at least a full decade before antihypertensive medication became widely available, especially to blacks in the rural South. Kaplan's explanation is compatible with the vast epidemiological literature documenting an inverse gradient between socioeconomic status conventionally measured by education, income, or occupation, and death from cardiovascular disease. Relative to where they started, Southern black women achieved the greatest upward social mobility between 1965 and 1980 than any other group. His explanation is also consistent with Lincoln and Phelan's theory concerning the fundamental social causes of health inequalities. This theory explains the persistence of socioeconomic and racial inequalities in health despite changes in the leading causes of death over time in terms of the ability of socioeconomic and racial elites to use money, knowledge, prestige, and beneficial social connections in a highly flexible way to protect their health. Hence, according to the fundamental social cause theory, a meaningful narrowing of the gap between Southern black and white women and access to these resources due to mid-1960s civil rights legislation would logically result in a narrowing of black-white disparities in diseases that were responsive to the flexible use of these resources by black women. In the 1960s and 70s, heart disease and stroke were among such responsive diseases. Most cancers were not. Returning now to race as a political relationship between, say, U.S. blacks and whites. Before the 1964 Civil Rights Act abolished de jure racial segregation, the political relationship between blacks and whites in the U.S. South had all the hallmarks of a caste system. This means that any discussion of how socioeconomic status influenced changes in the ratio of black-white cardiovascular disease mortality after 1964 that does not take into account the South's caste system is incomplete. For blacks in the Jim Crow South, the extreme restrictions placed on black freedom by the caste system, that extra layer of exclusion and domination to which even the poorest whites in the South were not subjected, could have only intensified the harmful effects of low socioeconomic status on the cardiovascular health of Southern blacks. 50 years ago, anthropologist Gerald Merriman described caste systems as follows. A caste system occurs where a society is made up of birth-ascribed groups, which are hierarchically ordered and culturally distinct. The hierarchy entails differential evaluation, rewards, and association. Differential evaluation refers to ascribed differences in intrinsic worth, purity, as in India, or genetically determined capabilities, as in the U.S. Differential rewards refers to differential access to goods and services, such as unequal pay for equal work, and differential power to influence the behavior of others. Differential association refers to the interactional hierarchy. One's social rank is expressed and validated, and who may be one's friends, wife, neighbor. And in the context of the Jim Crow South, I would add to this list, who could share a meal at the same table, use the same eating utensils, the same bathroom, attend the same school, etc. Only within the caste system is status equality found. Further, according to Merriman, caste systems are characterized by an elaborate etiquette of inter-caste relations, stringently enforced from within and above. In caste systems, social deference is a group, not an individual matter, and such deference is required. In the Jim Crow South of my youth, this meant that blacks were expected to be overtly submissive to whites in both speech and behavior, careful about when to engage whites with direct eye contact, required to address white children with titles of respect, for example, Little Miss So-and-so or Little Mr. So-and-so, even though whites, regardless of their age, were expected to address blacks by their first name or, not knowing their names, address them simply as boy or girl, regardless of the black person's age or social class. One must wonder then how much such day-to-day disrespect and forced subordination affected the cardiovascular physiology of Southern blacks during the Jim Crow era. Even though Robert Sapolsky, the well-known primatologist, did not discuss race or caste in his excellent 2005 Science article on social hierarchy and the health of primates, it is difficult to believe that none of his findings about how in non-human primates a stressful social rank causes widespread and harmful physiological changes applied to humans. In most social species, Sapolsky wrote, dominance rank influences the extent to which an individual sustains physical and psychological stressors. When the hierarchy is stable, in species where dominant animals actively subjugate subordinates, it is the latter who are most socially stressed, as indicated, for example, by basal hypertension, elevated glucocorticoids, decreased immune responsiveness to challenge, etc. This reflects the high rates of physical and psychological harassment of subordinates, their relative lack of social control and predictability, their need to work harder to obtain food, and their lack of social outlets, such as grooming or displacing aggression onto someone more subordinate. To me, this seems like an apt description of the active subjugation of black Southerners by whites during 250 years of slavery, followed by 100 years of Jim Crow. But Sapolsky is careful to emphasize that the relationship between social rank and primate health is context-dependent. During major hierarchical reorganization, he wrote, it is the dominant individuals who typically experience the greatest amounts of physical and psychological stress. This slide from Sapolsky's article illustrates the multiple physiological systems that are adversely impacted in primates who occupy the more stressful social ranks. In public health circles, we frequently refer to this panoply of effects as increased allostatic load or weathering. Though definitive proof is impossible, it is not unreasonable to speculate that through a variety of etiological pathways, economic, political, and psychological, the 1964 abolition of Jim Crow laws led to a rapid decrease in the allostatic load of Black Southerners, especially Blacks in the rural South, where both racial subjugation and material deprivation were most extreme. Before I conclude, a second and closer look at Lincoln Phelan's theory of the fundamental social causes of health disparities, especially their 2015 extension of the theory to include systemic racism as a fundamental cause of health disparities, should help us visualize just how important the expansion of Black freedom was and still is to our efforts to eliminate U.S. racial health inequalities. To quickly review, Lincoln Phelan attribute enduring socioeconomic, racial, and racial health inequalities to the ability of socioeconomic and racial elites to use in a flexible way their money, knowledge, prestige, power, and beneficial social connections to reduce their group, not just their individual, vulnerability to preventable diseases. Non-elites cannot do this to the same degree. Lincoln Phelan's early work focused on SES rather than race or racism. While I greatly admire their theory, I believe it suffers from two shortcomings. The first is, as I suggest in this slide, they seem to give equal weight to the five resources that so reliably connect the SES gradient to SES health inequalities. The second is, they under-theorize the relationship between and among the five resources. The authors should address both issues, not only to clarify their causal reasoning, but also to identify potential avenues to intervene on SES and racial health inequalities. In my view, power is more important than the other four resources, because without it, individuals or groups cannot influence the outcomes they consider important. I also believe that power results from the aggregation and concentration of the other resources, and further, that power and the other four resources enjoy a recursive relationship. It is the power differential, then, that makes it possible for members in the higher social ranks to dominate and control those in the lower social ranks, eventually producing the SES differences in both allostatic load and chronic degenerative diseases. Last year, Phelan and Link applied their fundamental cause theory to Black-white racial disparities in the U.S. They concluded that the ability of whites to flexibly use a variety of institutional resources, such as those shown here, their greater access to individual-level resources, and their use of highly resilient negative stereotypes of blacks makes racism a fundamental cause of health disparities above and beyond SES, a point David Williams was the first to make. But what is new and important in Phelan and Link's discussion of racism as a fundamental cause of health disparities is their inclusion of white's historic restriction of black freedom as an additional important mechanism through which systemic racism creates racial health inequities. Once again, however, I consider the causal model to be under-theorized. Not only has the power of whites to dominate and control blacks flowed from their greater control of institutional and individual resources, but in addition, history suggests the existence of a dialectical relationship between black freedom and white power and control, and white power and control. Indeed, our country's troubled racial history suggests that its white power, used in the service of white racial domination and control, expands, black freedom contracts. Conversely, as black freedom expands, the power of white racism contracts. By this account, black-white racial health inequities rise and fall in concert. The next six slides are iconic photographs from the 1960s civil rights movement. Each slide, I believe, illuminates the dialectical relationship between the 1960s struggle to expand black freedom and the flexible use of white power to restrict that freedom. I will present the photographs in chronological order without comment. I will conclude with this summary slide. It shows how Jim Crow laws and forced black deference to whites reinforced long-standing mechanisms of systemic racism, and how collective black agency, that is, collective black resistance to subjugation and exclusion, in combination with civil rights era legislation, expanded black freedom, abolished America's racial caste system, and through this, reduced black-white health inequities by fostering reductions in the systemic biological wear and tear that black Southerners in particular had endured for centuries. It does not require much imagination to see how a replay of this dialectical relationship in one, the mass incarceration of black Americans, and the now urgent calls to eliminate racism from our criminal justice system, and two, the excessive use of lethal force by police against black men, and the response in the form of the Black Lives Matter movement. While our journey toward health, toward racial health equity in America has been long and difficult, and progress has always been grudging, the road that has brought us this far has been true to America's core values of justice, equality, and yes, freedom for all. We must stay the course. I would like to thank the Awards Committee again for this honor, the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation for financial support that supported the work on this project, and Matthew McCurdy, my very able research assistant at Emory University. I thank you.
We will entertain any questions from our members of the audience, and I know you're skilled at doing this. You don't need me to moderate. I'll just point folks out if you need.
Okay.
Wally?
Thank you. Excellent talk. It's always a fabulous review. Bringing things inferentially into a chain. And I'm kind of curious, and I'm looking at this from the perspective of, say, the immigrant questions that France is struggling with now. They have a large Muslim population that is facing a lot of discrimination because they've chosen to remain culturally distinct. And so they're creating a backlash against their culture because they're not becoming French. They're not learning the language and learning discussions. We've passed laws to end official segregation. And so that is no longer legal. And I think we're trying as a country to do all the things to eliminate the over systemic. There are other things, though, culturally, and I'm curious of your perspective on this, where my wife teaches in a minority school, and there are modes of dress, there are modes of speech, there are cultural practices that seem to reinforce a distinctness of the black culture versus the white culture. Given that the whites historically have the power, do the blacks need to assimilate more to the white culture to achieve racial equity, health equity, or can racial health equity be achieved without that, do you think? I guess I'm trying to say there, it's almost like now that there's more freedom, there's this drive to get a distinctiveness, but that is not necessarily recognized or appreciated by those in the traditional power. So it seems like we're almost widening the gap versus narrowing it. And so your perspective on that?
Well, you put your finger on a really important and obviously difficult question. The thrust of my talk, if you listen carefully, and I'm sure you did, was that what we have, racial discrimination, it seems to me, affects marginalized groups, pariah groups, if you will, and African Americans continue to be a pariah group in American society. Through two mechanisms, they're correlated, two pathways. One is exclusion, and the other one is domination.
Second one is
domination. And as I mentioned in the course of my talk, much of the extant research on racial discrimination and health focuses more on exclusion. There's been almost nothing, from what I've been able to see, on domination. So it seems to me that you have like four possibilities. You can be, each of which has some implications for health and health equity. You can be excluded and dominated. You can be excluded and left alone. That almost never happens. You can be included and dominated, which I submit is sort of the current situation. And you can be included and treated as an equal. That's where we want to go. And I suspect that there is some health protection being afforded to marginalized groups when they feel and indeed know that they are not being accepted by the dominant society. There's some health protection afforded them when they hold on to their traditional culture, that there is health protection involved with that. One's religious identity, one's cultural identity, one's national identity, one's language, one's attire, the way that you address. All of these things signal who you are and that you belong to something larger, that you have a history, you belong to a people whose history and culture need to be understood and respected. So, if we cannot have, I mean, it seems to me of the two, of the four possibilities, if we cannot have what I think we need in order to completely eliminate racial and ethnic and other kinds of health disparities, sexual orientation, and so on, if we cannot have inclusion and equality, then the next best thing may be exclusion and being left alone. Because the other possibilities have inherent within them intrinsic inequalities, at least the potential, therefore. So we need to understand what it is the young people in your wife's care, how do they see the world? How are they interpreting their life experience? And what does it mean to present themselves to the larger world in a particular way?
In the current context of what we're seeing in current American culture and society as it pertains to Black Lives Matter, and I'm thinking about it in the context of what you presented today, where you have a group that tried to define and essentially ascribe its power, and there's been this push of over-dominating them or Haitsman in a particular scenario seems to be subservient or seems to be less than their intent. And the change in that narrative is for us. For example, I can tell you how many people say, well, it's a terrorist organization, or how Black Panthers were described, the young lords being from the civil rights movement. So it seems that some of the lessons that we pass have not necessarily been learned or been absorbed in a way that are impactful for providing a change to go to that fourth tier. What do you say, or what is your, I guess, reflection around that, what you're seeing with respect to that, this societal change or shift in a very hardcore and negative response to these attempts by the current generation to define themselves to address the civil rights concerns?
Yeah, well, in the one sentence that I included in my talk, alluding to where we are today, because obviously I focused on the 60s and 70s, I mean, I certainly see what we are experiencing as yet another, and to me, a very clear manifestation of this dialectical relationship. That the mass incarceration, I mean, it's on that continuum of racial domination, exclusion and domination. The excessive use of force, lethal force, by the police against Black men in particular. How else do you interpret that except as an insistence on domination? And I think that, you know, I mean, myself as a product of the civil rights movement of the early 1960s, I actually graduated from college at a historic Black college, as Laurie mentioned, and in the introduction, June 1st, 1964. Lyndon Johnson signed the 1964 Civil Rights Bill 1 month after I graduated. Imagine what a difference that made in terms of my life trajectory. Imagine. But I think that my generation, we were more hopeful. I don't think that we or anybody else for that matter, had any clear idea of just how resilient this sentiment, you know, that this country belongs to a certain group of people who look a certain way, belongs to them. And any, you know, when that sense gets to be threatened, then you're going to see the kind of backlash that we see. You're going to see the policies. You're going to see a retreat from policies that were, in fact, promotive of equality and health equality in addition. You're going to see a retreat from the policies that really would move us toward, if appropriately enforced, if people could really stop seeing this as a zero-sum game, which we do. And I think that the dialectical relationship that I talked about, you know, represents kind of a zero-sum game. And we need to get out of that. We need to break out of that particular paradigm. I think that the Black Lives Matter movement, in a sense, goes much deeper to address what the real problem is. In a sense, you see, as I was about to say a moment ago, those of us who came of age in the early to mid 1960s, we were very optimistic, we were very idealistic about the ability to really achieve equality. And I think we underestimated just how difficult that is, how strong the backlash would be. The young people who are involved in the Black Lives Matter movements, they have not underestimated that. They know that this is really, really difficult. And I think that the Black Lives Matter movement goes straight to the heart of the problem. Black Lives Matter. And I don't know what obviously no one knows what the future is going to hold, but especially, you know, after November. But I think that we are likely to be faced with the same kind of hard-fought battle for further progress that we were faced with in the 1950s and before. I see a re-engagement of the same kinds of forces to stall progress, to stall equality, to roll back the progress that we have made. Kamara.
I have so appreciated your lecture, especially your last comments about the Black Lives Matter movement. I just wanted to let people in this room know that every year the APHA president can give a presidential citation to a person or group, and I have chosen to give my presidential citation to the Black Lives Matter movement, and that will be listed at the award ceremony tomorrow. But also, as we appreciate the youth and that work, they need us still, because they don't really necessarily have all of the history. And in fact, I heard at the Morehouse School of Medicine, I guess last year, in a group of first-year medical students, we were talking about some of the demonstrations and all, and one young student said, well, at least ours is the first generation who's taking action. And you know, we can't blame them if we haven't taught them. Because they're not getting it in the schools, right? Or in Saturday programs or anything. And so even as we are so heartened now that they're picking up the struggle of their generation, they still need to be tied to us. And we still need to tell them what strategies we tried that worked and the strategies we tried that failed. We need to make sure that they're grounded in history and not just applaud them from afar. We need to be connected struggles as well, but I just really appreciated your comment.
So I was just at a presentation a few months ago by NIH in terms of this precision personalized medicine initiative, this large cohort effort that they're going to pour a lot of resources in, and I didn't hear anything discussed about racial ethnic differences and really specifically targeting groups to understand racial ethnic differences within that huge investment that we're making. And I don't know if you can comment, and you know more than I do, but if you can comment on that.
I assure you I don't know any more than you do. But this is an opening for me to say that, and I hope that what you took away from my talk was that for the progress that we made in the 1960s, right, and through the 70s, during that really important 10 to 15 year period, all hands were on deck to make that happen. All hands were on deck. The medical care community was on deck. Grassroots movement, grassroots folks were on deck. You know, organized civil rights organizations like SCLC and NAACP on deck. The judiciary, the Supreme Court on deck. White House on deck. Everybody was on deck. That's what it takes. So there's no silver bullet. There's no silver bullet. It takes all of these forces operating together, moving toward a common goal. And when that happens, you can see real progress. And I believe that such progress can, in terms of racial health equity, that it will come pretty quickly. It will come pretty quickly. But it's so easy, because of this dialectical relationship, for things to roll back. So I'm all right with personalized medicine, as long as it's, and this is, I understand to be the thrust of a comment, as long as it is rolled out, if you will, within this larger context of what else needs to happen in order for us to move forward.
The lack of impact that evidence can have.
And when I try to apply that to my own work, I think, okay, I pursued a PhD so that I could produce evidence. Not evidence to prove anything for them, but evidence to guide me and communities and others to help guide the actions that we take. So what does it mean to produce evidence if the evidence is ignored, or I'm really wondering, what do we do with the production of evidence when there's a lot of years?
Yeah. Well, I mean, I think Kamara sort of hinted at it in a way. I think we should be in the business of giving away our knowledge, empowering people, empowering young people with knowledge, right, with evidence. Because knowledge really is empowering. And we need to give away our knowledge to grassroots people. We need to be out in the community talking with people, telling them about what the facts are, so that as they mobilize around in ways that are designed to protect themselves and protect their communities, they have facts to work with, right? And that helps to sort of undermine the myths that are out there and the misinformation, because they will have facts to work with, and we arm them with knowledge. So I think we should just keep going, because the knowledge that you are producing and that we're trying to produce is very useful and empowering knowledge for young people and for people who did not get the chance to go to college, who did not get the chance to get a master's degree or a PhD degree. And for those of us who have been involved in community-based participatory research, we know how important it is to be in dialogue with communities. And they get it, you know. You know, if we do a good job of demystifying, you know, the statistics, put it in plain language, they get it and they respond.
So one of the things which has been striking to me is that how the current state of race relations in this country has been more adverse to black men than to black women. I mean, I'm not, but at least in terms of the prison stuff and graduation from college and graduate school and so forth. And I wondered if you had any thoughts about that in terms of causation, but also in terms of what the implications of that are for health and whether it will produce or has already produced different trends among black men and women.
You probably have no idea how controversial your question is. There is a body of literature that goes under the rubric social dominance theory, a dimension of which argues that the males in the pariah groups, in the outcast groups, are targeted more aggressively than the females in those groups. That's called it's something like the targeted male hypothesis or something to that degree. Anyway, Sedanius and Prato are the primary proponents of the social dominance theory. So they've written about that very issue very carefully, and they've looked at it on a global basis. And George Kaplan and colleagues, one of the things that they talked about when they were trying to explain how it is that black women experience much more dramatic reductions in heart disease mortality and stroke mortality than black men, there's a passage in their paper that talks about how, you know, when opportunities for blacks, say in the late 1960s, to move into better jobs that had been historically closed off to them, that black women may have been given preferential treatment over black men because black men were threatening, would be too threatening, and that black men came under closer scrutiny, more aggression. I chose for perhaps obvious reasons not to talk about that in my talk, because I do believe that, I mean, I do think that there's something to this double jeopardy issue. I do believe that black women are discriminated against both on the basis of race and sex, and that the discrimination that black women face is qualitatively different than that black men face, but not necessarily more deleterious or less deleterious. And then, too, there are biological differences between black men and black women. That we know that premenopausally, you know, stress doesn't have the same adverse consequences on the cardiovascular health of black women that it has on their health once they go through the change of life, or on black men. So we cannot ignore altogether the role of biology in trying to understand how stress can impact differentially male and female, regardless of race, susceptibility to cardiovascular disease, and how that can change over time or with age. So I think this is a very controversial topic. One should talk about it with more nuance than is typically the case. We just don't understand this issue as carefully and as deeply as we need to.
Chair's privilege and ask a final question.
Okay.
And it comes from my experience of being a local epidemiologist at a county in New York. In your talk, you just brought back to mind a few things as I was developing community health assessments for my county. You know, speaking about immigrant populations, for a more specific example, where the majority of the immigrants that we had in our communities were either from Eastern European, Ultra Orthodox, or ironically, we had Irish immigrants. In fact, we have the largest population of undocumented Irish immigrants than any other state, or any other county within the state. And it's surprising because when you look at the imagery or the concerns around disparity or equity or health-related concerns, the immigrant issues were never among those majority populations, but the ones that more similarly either looked as Latino-American or Latino, let's say, or African-based cultures. And the push back against how to address equity in the development of health priorities and improve the health communities were always seem to be succeeded against the construct of, well, the ones who are the most problematic are the ones who are marginalized versus the fact, as I said, I have the largest Irish American group who wear. And it's not even anecdotal. When you go into a particular community, you say, or a bar, and say you want ice, people worry because they're thinking ice as far as they. that's not even a joke. So it's interesting when we have these conversations, but certain groups seem to be not necessarily associated with that that construct and painted against a larger image of the dominant culture, dominant society, how groups kind of assimilate into some very easily, and others are constantly excluded. What do you say in some shape or form is the best effort into accomplishing the fourth dimension you spoke about, whether or not it's inclusion with equality or inclusion with being left alone? Either of those two, what do you think will be the capstone in allowing that transition to hopefully improve the status of health and equity and equality in our communities?
It is a tough question. An impossibly tough question. Well, in my more optimistic days, I'll put my faith in the young people. Those of us who are privileged to be in the classroom with young people have an awesome responsibility to educate them, to try to be a good role model, to be civic-minded, to be respectful of people who are different, to understand differences, to value differences, to understand that in diversity there is strength. We don't all want to be alike. We don't all want to be alike. We don't want... At least I don't think it's good you know, for our nation, maybe any nation, for people to become so assimilated that there's no rich cultural diversity. So I don't think there's very much danger of that happening, quite frankly. And so it seems to me that the only real option we have, you know, is to try to figure out how we can move to a place as a nation. And I don't think this is going to happen in any of our lifetimes, but we must stay the course. We must persist. We must not give up to move toward inclusion and equality. Inclusion and the absence of domination. See, that's what we have now. We have inclusion, but we have the domination of people who have been included on a token basis. And so when young people on college campuses talk about microaggression, that's what they're talking about. They're talking about these symbols or these symbolic acts or language that put them down, that make them feel less than, that are intended to disempower them. That's what they're getting at. So they're responding to the forces, these very subtle forces of domination that follows their inclusion. That is harmful. That is harmful because then people want to retreat into their own groups, where there is safety, where there is value, where there is a sense of community and a sense of self-worth. And so I think that we as educators, and you know, as a public health leader in your state, we need to broaden the conversation, get more players on the field, right? Get more perspectives, get more players on the field, in the spirit of what I said earlier about all hands on deck, to figure out how we go about creating, you know, this more ideal, I think, more equitable and more genuinely American situation. I don't expect that to happen anytime soon.
Thank you, Dr. James, for those that thoughtful comments. And I want to thank all of you for coming. I feel in awe to be in this room with these giants in epidemiology. And they may not believe it, but each of them actually had an influence in my career. Dr. James, you may not remember, but you had me as a 10-hour-a-week research assistant, even though you weren't in North Carolina. And I learned so much on you were trying to check the feasibility of doing following up on the cross-sectional study you had in Pitt County. And I learned so much that time. And Vic, I was one of those students that led the minority student conference. And your guidance was so helpful. And, you know, you really felt like you could do something. And I really appreciate that. And Polly was the chief when I was the EIS officer. And that was probably the first year that the MDs and the PhDs made the same amount of money. I mean, and Polly made that happen. Polly made that happen. You know, so you never know what your contribution is going to be to the life of others. So I just feel so thankful for all of you to be here. And I'm sure all of you have stories to tell about these wonderful people who have really influenced epidemiology. So thank you so much. And we do want to take a group picture of all of the award recipients with their awards. And I want to announce we will have a reception that's starting. It will be in this room 6 to 7:30 today, and we hope that you will come. You'll get another chance to speak with our award recipients and just share with each other the wonderful discipline we have as an epidemiologist. Isn't it great? So anyway, thank you for coming.